We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
And if you'd like to call in here and talk with Scott Spies, 333-9455 is the number. Calling with a pledge is not required. If you have a question, you just call a regular number, 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thank you very much.
Good morning, Dave. How are you doing?
I'm okay. How are you?
It's been a great day. A little chilly out there, but on the way to work, I'm looking at all these leaves blowing around, thinking, wow, it just feels like it's coming earlier and earlier. Unfortunately, leaves do mean blocked gutters. So once again, it's about time to go out there and make sure all your gutters have downspouts and get that water out and away, because when we start getting the snow melt off the roof, we want to make sure it doesn't end up in the basements or crawl space areas.
Yeah, okay. So you want to make sure that the gutters are clear, the water's going to drain the way that it should, and you want it to drain away from the house. You don't want it, whatever you do, you don't want it dripping down right next to the foundation.
Well, particularly in houses that are newer, and we've got a lot of houses in this area that are anywhere from newer, I'm going to qualify anything from 10 to 15 years old. Mm-hmm. When they built the house, they have to dig down to put in the foundation. When they dig down to put in the foundation, they have a nice big hole. They put a little bit of concrete in, bring up the basement wall, the crawl space wall. Then on the outside, they fill the hole back in with some dirt. Well, in the first 10 to 15 years around the outside of the house, that dirt settles, and it creates what I like to refer to as the moat around the castle. And if your downspouts do not get extended out past this this low area or this area that subsided just a little bit, you do end up with a catch basin that will actually direct water back towards the foundation. So the biggest thing, of course, nowadays is to landscape the house with a landscape mulch or a landscape bark or even a gravel. And the settlement of the soil in the first foot or two around the foundation isn't as noticeable because the gravel, mulch, et cetera, covers it up. But it still exists, and water doesn't see the gravel. It doesn't see the bark. It kind of soaks down through it. So you really need to pay attention to that. And if you've got an issue where you've got a basement corner that likes to get wet, or you've got a crawl space that occasionally gets some water, there's a very good bet that what's happened is we have had some of this soil settlement next to the foundation. And really, it's not rocket science. You rake the gravel out, rake the mulch back, put a little bit more dirt in there, and put the plastic up. Now, I will tell people that when they are putting in a little bit more soil around the outside of the house, not to get it too high on the house. You have to remember that behind your siding is some wood framing, and the last thing we want to do is keep that dirt up against our siding and keep it up against that wood siding where we can allow any moisture to get there. The wood siding or the vinyl siding protects the wood relatively well, but if you've got the dirt right up to it, we've got a hidden entry point for bugs, termites, mm-hmm. things like that. So. Yeah.
And it's, I think some people, you know, when you look at the landscaping around your house, maybe if you're lucky, you might be on a little bit higher spot where you get the kind of slope that you would like. Some people, like me, for example, it's just kind of in a little bit of a low spot, and it's pretty flat around the house. And it's pretty tough to get much slope away from the house when it's sitting like that. There's really not a whole lot you can do about it. But at the very least, I guess you would say, well, you know, go get as much slope as you possibly can.
Generally, I like to see at least the first 3 to 5 feet away from the house to have the best slope. On a lot that is really flat, instead of putting your gravel or your mulch down on top of a landscape fabric, you could rake it back and put in 2 feet or so of plastic up against the house 2 feet out, and then put your gravel on top of that plastic. Now any water that hits in the first 2 feet has to move out 2 feet before it can soak down, and hopefully by the time it soaks down and it tries to go back towards the foundation, it has dropped far enough to where it doesn't come in the basement or down into the crawl space.
Yeah.
There are some areas in Champaign-Urbana that have very high silt content or clay content, and water does not percolate or drain very well. So there are some areas that just plain get wet, some soggy areas. Personally, I think there's a reason that some of the farmers sell off a couple of acres here and there. They can't grow any crops there, so you might as well put some houses in. And unless they get around to raising the houses up out of the ground far enough to get some slope, you can end up with some damp problems. So grading around the outside. Now, the reason I was thinking of all the grading is trying to get to the station here this morning. We've got dump trucks everywhere doing all this work around Springfield Avenue and around University Avenue. And I'm like, wow, now there's a truckload of dirt I could use around the house.
Okay, well, if you got questions here, you want to talk with our guest, Scott Spies. He's an inspector, home inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service, and he's on the program once a month. It's always on a Monday. And we're here and open to your questions. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Anything else that you just would say that is sort of a routine thing, exterior, that's related to the time of year we are, you know, besides making sure that your gutters are clean and your downspouts are on there?
Well, it's a good time to go around and check your storm windows. Make sure your storm windows close and look like they seal pretty well. You don't want to caulk the bottom of your storm windows. I know a lot of particularly first-time home buyers on an older house that have an aluminum storm window. Let's seal all the air out so you get out the caulking gun. You don't really want to caulk the bottom of your storm window frame. If you ever have the storm up and water blows through the screen, you've got to have a place for it to drain out at the bottom. So a storm window works very well if it's sealed on basically three sides and just kept closed. Now, when we get a good cold snap like we're having, this weekend, if you notice you've got some condensation on the storm windows, on the exterior window, but not on the inside, that usually means the storm window is actually sealing better than your prime window. So that means you need to say, okay, why is my prime window leaking air, or has the bottom of that storm window blocked up? Your prime window, when you close and latch it, should have enough of an air seal that we're not getting the warm, humid air to the cold storm window. So when you see a little bit of moisture on the window, we can do a little detective work and figure out, okay, where's this moisture coming from? If it's on the inside window, it usually means the humidity level in the house is too high. If it's on the outside window, then it's usually an indication that the outside window is sealing better than the inside window, and so we're getting the moisture going all the way through.
Yeah. We got some callers here, and we'd be happy to take questions. 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455, and we'll start with a caller on our line one. Right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
I got a question related to one earlier. I've had some water come into my basement, and I have put in new eaves troughs, and I've covered the wheel wells with plastic, and I'm still getting some water in. I'm wondering what you think about digging up alongside the foundation, maybe digging down 3 feet or so, and then applying some tar and putting some Visqueen down, and then grading the ground away from the foundation.
Well, when the house is built, that's usually what they'll do is before they fill in the fill grade or the grade next to the foundation, they will usually put some type of waterproofing on there. The problem with doing that now is that you've now created a whole new bunch of loose dirt because you dug down alongside your foundation. And so it tends to, for the next several years, act as a sponge and draw more water towards it because that ground is more absorbent or percolates better than the harder packed soil around the house. Is there a particular corner that you're getting some water from? Or in other words, we probably ought to do a little sleuthing and see if we can't figure out where that water is coming from or what water is it that is ending up towards the basement. Is it water from a gutter? Is it a low spot in the yard that tends to drain that way? Things like that. And see if we can't figure out where the water is and get it away from the house. Waterproofing the house is not a bad idea, but if we can get the water to run away on the surface or figure out where it's coming from and divert it away before it runs towards the house, usually that'll work better. But, yes, some type of perimeter tile or a drainage system will work if we can't figure out anything else.
Take some other preliminary steps and then go to the other approach.
That it would be my approach to it, yes, is to try and figure out where it is that we can get it away from easily on the surface. And I always figure it's easier to try and figure out where the water is coming from rather than try and waterproof the house and prevent it from getting into the basement.
Okay. Real fine. Thank you much.
All right. Thank you. Let's go on to another caller here, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
This little this question is a little related with the gentleman who just called. We have a basement with same problem, and we did hire somebody who dig on the front of our yard, and then they put tar and they put plastic and the ground back, and we have same water than before. The problem is not finished, and every time it rains, we have tons of water to get out of the basement. That's one thing. And the other thing I would like to ask, if is any way that we can fix the pipes, because when somebody's taking a shower in one bathroom and somebody else open a faucet in another bathroom, well, we get a very hot water or very cold water. I believe this is a common problem, but we don't know how to solve it. Or if it have a solution, that's it.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, well, first with basement, if doing some tiling and regrading around the front of the house doesn't correct it, then we need to figure out, again, where is that water coming from? Water coming into a basement can be a perimeter tile that is broken. Most time when they build a basement, they do put a tile around the outside of the house that hopefully is draining water away from the foundation. But if you've got a downspout that goes into an old tile, depending on the age of the house and the area of the town that it was built, we may actually have a perimeter tile that is taking some downspout from the far side of the house and actually coming in on an opposite wall because the water in that footing tile is able to get out. Worst case scenario, of course, we have to start putting in sump pumps and putting in basement drainage systems to collect that water. If we can't fix it from the outside, then we go to the inside. I know there's an awful lot of places that can do some type of waterproofing to try and keep the water, collect the water once it comes into the basement. But first, I would exhaust all my options is to try and keep it out from the outside.
Thank you.
And what about the other question? And I'm sure this is the kind of thing that other people have experienced. It say somebody's in the shower, and somebody you flush a toilet or maybe even open up a tap somewhere else, and it disturbs the balance of the system to the point where either the person gets a shot of really cold water or maybe they get a shot of really hot water. What can you do about that?
Well, there's not a lot that can be done. Usually that means that there was a tee that wasn't put in quite right, so the water wants to divert from one faucet to another. It can be a low flow problem. Usually we'll find that in an older home that has steel pipes where we can have a little bit of corrosion inside the pipes. So the volume of the water moving through there is not as great. So when you go to divert it into two different directions, you can get a quick drop in the water pressure. That's more of a problem for a plumber to try and run down and make sure that we don't have an issue. It may be a matter that we need to change how the tea goes to the water heater so that the water goes to the water heater first before it starts going to the rest of the house so that when you are using your hot water and all of a sudden there's a sudden change that it doesn't have a drastic effect on the hot water pressure.
Okay. That'd be the kind of thing, though, that somebody would have to kind of look and see how your system is set up. And then see if they can figure out, is there something that they can do to make some change or fine-tune it so that you don't get that problem?
And it's interesting this question did come up because I did spend this weekend replumbing one of our rental houses. And one of the things that I did was I made a separate – the bathroom is a fairly long ways away from the water heater. And I made sure that I ran a separate tee from the water heater to the bathroom, but then ran the water line for the toilet from the kitchen area, not from the bathroom area, so that it would be farther away so that they would have less effect on the bathroom water pressure. So I ran a separate cold water line for the lav and the bathroom that I did for the toilet in the kitchen area.
All right. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Scott Spies. He's a home inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service. And he and his dad have been doing this program with us for a long, long time. And way back when we started doing Focus 580, we thought, well, what are some of the questions that people will always have? And we knew that there would always be questions about wet basements and frozen pipes and insulation and heating and cooling and all that sort of stuff. And we thought, well, there would be enough questions so that we could do this every month and be assured that we would get lots of calls from listeners. And that has always been the case all the time that we have been doing this show. Now, we do programs here about news events and about issues in the news. But we also do shows like this that are designed to try to give you some practical, useful information. Now, if you have benefited, and I know that there are people who listen regularly to these programs. I've even known people who've listened who weren't even homeowners. They just listened because they thought there was good information here. Now's the time for you to step up and be a supporter of this and everything else you listen to on this station. And you can do that. It's just very easy. You can do that by calling us. You can go online. The important thing is that you help us out and help us meet our fundraising goal for this fall fund drive. Here in studio with me this morning is Dave Teal. He's the program director for WILL-TV. We don't see him all that often up here. We're glad to have you here with us.
Oh, glad to be here. I occasionally have sat in where you're sitting as a fill-in, but it's something I don't get to do as often as I'd like. I guess you need to take more vacations.
That would be okay with me. We'll talk about that later. You know, I know that I talked a little bit about the people supporting the station. You know what I didn't do? I didn't give the phone number.
No, it's 217-244-9455. And this is, of course, a listener-supported station. This is our fall membership campaign, and we're here today to ensure that the programs that you enjoy today continue to be here tomorrow, and that's the ultimate goal of this campaign. And, you know, we like being able to bring in these local experts to answer your questions and with specific information for Central Illinois and, of course, also some general information. I think that's valuable to listeners wherever they may be. And, we have many listeners on the web from all across the country. Your pledges of support help us to bring these programs to you and also to bring in authors and various other experts to talk about important issues of the day. 217-244-9455 is the number to call. To make that pledge right now, we want to hear from at least 300 new supporters during this fall campaign.
And we'll be here today, and
yes,
we'll be here for a few hours tomorrow morning on Morning Edition. And for this fall, that's it. And, you know, one of the things that we have really tried very hard to do over time is to make our pledge periods as short as we possibly can. Because, after all, what we want to be doing is doing the programming. But we do periodically have to do this to remind people of their support. And this is also the best way that we have of talking to people who are not current friends.
Right.
You know, to those folks, we want to say, hey, you know, thanks. We wouldn't still be here without you. But we really need as much as possible to hear from people who are listeners but not yet supporters.
Yeah. And we do a great amount of local programming, which is a nice thing. I mean, that's something that a lot of radio stations these days can't say. That, you know, they're mm-hmm. owned by you know, national conglomerates. Everything is programmed out of one central hub. But, you know, we produce hours and hours of programs that come right out here of East Central Illinois and beam their way all across the country via the web.
Yeah, and it's not even something that all public stations can do. We're
right.
lucky that we have the resources to do that. But again, I think we have to come back to remind people that the reason we have those resources is that individuals like the folks who are listening this morning also help pay the cost of the program.
Yeah. And if this is important to you, and we know that for some of you it really is, we hope that we'll hear from you right now at 217-244-9455. Make that pledge right
now.
Yeah,
or you can go online. Go to willpledge.org. Hey, thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
This morning in this part of Focus, we're doing a program that we have been doing every month now for a long time, a show to try to help you with home maintenance kind of issues. And our guest is Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. So if you have a question about things at your house, maybe you got some kind of problem going on and you just don't quite know how to solve it, 333-9455. And toll free, 800-222-9455. I would think that probably by now most people have run their furnace, so they know if it works or not. I mean, they know do they have a problem or not. But past that, are there some? Can you really tell if things need to be adjusted, or maybe if the furnace is not working up to the efficiency that you would expect from it? Is that something that you can tell?
Well, the efficiency of the furnace is going to be helped by how much air moves through it. So, of course, since it is now heating season, it is time to double-check your air filter and make sure that you've got a good, clean filter so we're getting quite a bit of air through it. Some of the telltale signs of possible problems with the furnace is what I'll call short cycling of the fan system. If the furnace kicks on and then it blows warm air for a while and all of a sudden it shuts off and then a few minutes later it turns back on, that's usually an indication that either we're not getting enough air through the system or we're getting too much air through the system or the burner is not creating enough heat. So if the furnace starts doing strange things, if it seems to be running all the time or continuous, usually an indication that, hey, we're not getting the heat we're supposed to out of it. It's trying to heat the house. It's not getting through. But the other thing we have to worry about, because it is heating season and most of the furnaces in this area are natural gas, we want to make sure people have checked their carbon monoxide detector. It's been a couple of years now since the state has made it mandatory that every house have a carbon monoxide detector in the house. Ideally, you're supposed to have them in near a bedroom and on each level of the house. But that carbon monoxide detector does need to be checked to make sure that it is either plugged into a wall or has a good battery. Smoke alarms as well, as long as we're at it. But carbon monoxide is the silent deadly killer. Most of the furnaces we've got nowadays are high enough efficiency. They have an induction fan, so it'd be very, very difficult for any carbon monoxide to get into the house. But just to be on the safe side, you really should have a carbon monoxide detector. It is a state law to have one up and running and in the house to make sure that we don't have any problems.
And I think probably if you asked yourself, when was the last time you changed the batteries in your smoke detectors? And if you would have to say, well, I'm not sure, probably it would be a good idea to do that. I think, you know, one of the things that maybe that we try to promote the idea is that when the time changes, which is going to be in about 2 weeks, I think, go around, take them down, put new batteries in there, and just make sure that they will do the job that you want them to do.
Well, nowadays, most of the units, when the battery starts going down, they start chirping at you. So they're reminding you kind of incessantly that you need to change the battery. But it is a good idea to make sure that they are in working condition, because we are going into the heating season. And heating season does mean that we're running a little bit more natural gas and a little bit more flame. So yeah, things to be cautious of.
And for placement of the carbon monoxide detector, this is something where I think sometimes people are just a little bit unsure about where it should go.
There are some very specific requirements by the state. In my opinion, the most important one is going to be near the sleeping room. You don't want to be more than 15 feet from a carbon monoxide detector where you can hear it from a sleeping room, because that's where the carbon monoxide is going to be the biggest problem. Is when you're asleep, you end up with a buildup of carbon monoxide. Say you've got the room closed up, or the house is all closed up and you've got the furnace running. That is the critical time would be when you're asleep, because when you're up and about and going in and out of the doors and such, even if there is a little bit of carbon monoxide in the house, it's not as critical because you're going out and getting in fresh air and moving around. So make sure, if at all costs, we really need one within 15 feet of any sleeping room, upper level, lower level, within 15 feet of any and every sleeping room in the house.
All right. Our guest this morning is Scott Spies, and we're taking your questions on home maintenance. And if you have a question or a problem, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
The first floor of my house is very old. It was built like in 1939. And the previous owner screwed in all the old-fashioned storm windows, and the inside windows were stained shut. So I took out the storms, took the screws out a couple years ago, but I realized that when I went to open up the inside windows, not only were they stained shut, but a previous resident had siliconed them all on the inside. And I'm wondering if there's some easy way to remove all that silicone.
I wish. The answer is no. It's labor intensive. You've got to get silicone and such out, a good razor blade, razor knife. Cut it out. There is no easy way of getting it. There's nothing chemically that's going to strip it, soften it, or loosen it. So, the answer is definitely it's a pain.
Yeah, I just was hoping that when I went to do it, I wouldn't have to damage the finish as much as going to need to be damaged now by removing all that silicone.
Well, my guess is if they siliconed or they caulked the windows shut, that there's probably also an issue that they may not have enough or proper weather stripping around the windows, so they were trying to keep any and all air leakage around it. So once you get them up to where they're operable, opening and closing, you may have a little more air leakage around it than what you had originally planned on. So reworking.
There must be a better way to take care of that than to use permanent silicone.
Oh, there are several different ways of weather stripping windows, yes.
Yeah.
But
we did open a few of them, and I didn't seem to have too many problems with my power bill going up last year. So I'm planning on doing the rest this coming spring, but just thought there might be an easier way than how we did it last summer.
No easy way on that. Now, because you said the windows are relatively old, 60, 70 years old,
yeah.
Some weather stripping around the windows probably wouldn't be a bad idea to help make sure that they're sealed up well. There's a couple different types of weather strip kits where you can replace jams or some other ones that are self-adhesive that you can apply a little plastic V-strip on there that helps provide
right.
a little bit of weather stripping.
Right, we did that with some of the ones that we got open, and it doesn't seem maybe not quite as efficient as it was when they were completely sealed, but they seem to be doing all right. So, well, thanks very much.
Okay, very good. Let's go on to Piatone, line number two. Here's a caller. Hello.
Line two?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, Pisotum, actually.
Oh, okay. Well, sorry. Go ahead.
I have a question that has to do with installing air conditioning and heating, but the problem is this is for a church, and the people I've called that offer help, if it's not a tax-paying entity, they don't offer that service, and the power company hasn't been able to help either. They used to do an energy audit, but they don't do that anymore. My question is, where do you go to get somebody to help you do an energy audit to a building that's, you know, real tall ceilings, Gothic design, basically. We use it maybe 3 days a week for a couple hours a day. What kind of, you know, what's it going to pay to install for air conditioning or heat and something like that?
Well, because of the design of the building, it is going to take a little bit more ingenuity to get a good movement of air with a tall, high ceiling. All the heat likes to go to the top and kind of sits there. Actually, it works relatively well to install some fans up near the top that draw upward instead of blowing down. The warm air that collects near the ceiling is going to be several degrees warmer than what is going to be down low, but it's not going to feel warm if it's blowing on you. So if you were to put a ceiling fan that's drawing up, what it does is it draws the air from the middle of the building up to where the warm air is and takes warm air and puts it down around the outside edges, and that way you end up with a warm air barrier between the patrons and the cooler walls or the large window areas.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one. Basically, what we're going to have to work on is air circulation. We can't let the air just – you can't just put the warm air in and say, okay, that's going to warm it up, because it's all going to stratify up at the top end of that building. I don't have a good recommendation off the top of my head. I would look for some commercial heating and cooling contractors to see what they've got for resources, to see if they can come out and give you an idea what it's going to take. You've got a lot of large open areas, and that does make it more difficult. Now, cooling isn't as bad because the cold air does collect down where the people are, so we can just throw some cold air in. But keeping it warm and keeping it comfortable without drafts is going to be the tricky part. And you say you only run it for a couple of days a week, 3 or 4 days a week.
Right. Yeah, well, you got a lot of cycles up and down in there, and, you know, how much,
mm-hmm.
you know, geothermal, of course, is the most efficient, but does it pay to put geothermal cooling in for something like that where you're only going to run it that many times?
Now, there again, the geothermal, the heat pumps and things like that, they don't have quite the drop or increase in temperatures as a standard air conditioner or a gas or out there where you're at maybe LP furnace. Generally, the air pump systems, which would include the geothermal, only drop about 10 or 12 degrees, or excuse me, raise about 10 or 12 degrees. So if you've got the building sits empty for a while and it cools down to, say, 40 degrees, you're blowing 51 or 52 degree air trying to warm it back up, and it's going to take an awful long time for it to warm back up. So they may have to engineer something slightly different to where we can end up with maybe even a little electric auxiliary system to bring up the heat levels after it's been cooled down. Once you get it up to a normal temperature, say 65 or so. Now it's blowing a little bit warmer air, and so the heat pumps will work well. But when it's if you let it sit empty and turn the thermostats way down, and unfortunately, I've seen some of these what I'll call country churches or rural areas where they basically turn off the heat and or the cooling, and then expect it to be able to come back up in a day. And unless you're really well insulated, that's just not going to happen.
Right. Yeah. One other related question: How far can you safely turn it down without starting to ruin the plaster and the Art Deco and that kind of stuff?
Well, what happens is if you turn down the heat and the building gets quite cold, it dries out because obviously when it's very cold outside, most of our water has frozen and dropped out of the sky. And so our outdoor humidity levels have dropped. And if you really get the inside of the building dry, then all the wood wants to shrink. It's hard on paint. It's hard on the wood itself. So you have to really watch the humidity levels in the house, or in the building. Mm-hmm. I don't like to see them drop below about 55 degrees, mm-hmm. Particularly if you've got water lines in there for anything. That way you've got a little bit of a cushion. If something does break, if it stays at least around 55, then it's going to take it a day or so to get down into the 30s to where you've got some time to get somebody out there to get the system up and running so you don't have frozen pipes.
Yeah.
In residential, I rarely would recommend anybody turn it down more than 6 or 8 degrees over what I would consider their normal operating temperature, whatever that may be. My house sits at about 67 degrees, and if I were to set it down to 60 or so, I think it would take, particularly if it was for like a weekend or 3 or 4 days, which is basically what you're talking about, it's going to take so much more energy to bring it back up to temperature over a long period of time because everything in the house will cool off. The walls, the furniture, the floors, all the mass of the building will tend to cool off. So I'd really, particularly in residentials, don't like any more than about 6 degrees or 7 degrees. But for a church where you're going to be shutting it down for multiple days in a row, 55 is probably about the lowest that I'd really recommend setting it for the actual building materials.
Okay, no websites or any sources of information then I could...
Not that I know of right off the top of my head. We're just a little bit out of my area of expertise because I do mostly residential, a little bit of commercial, but nothing that I can think of right off the top of my head.
Okay, well, thanks.
All right, thank you. Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He has been with us here for quite some time, and then for a long time before that. His dad, Hank, used to do the show with us. The two of them have been doing the program for a long time, showing up every month to answer these kind of questions, and I know that they'll do their best to help you out if you got a problem. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let me just take a second here. Because I think this is something we've talked about before, and again, people seem to find it a little bit confusing. Ceiling fans, the kind that hang from the ceiling, have the big blades, look like airplane propellers. Okay. When do you want to have it blow down, and when do you want to have it pull the air up?
Actually, you'd be surprised about the number of people that don't realize that they are switchable directions.
Really, even a lot of people don't know that they go both ways.
There is a little black switch, usually right below the fan motor, that will change the direction that the fan runs. Cooling modes, the body will try and sweat to cool down, so air blowing on you will cool you. So in a cooling season, late spring, early fall, when we have a couple of warm days during the summer, the fan should be blowing down on you and should be blowing air across you, and that will help increase what I'll call the perceived comfort level of the house. You get a little bit of breeze blowing on you. You feel cool even though the house temperatures may be 80 higher depending on where you put your house. But in the wintertime, most people turn the fans off. If you've got a high ceiling room, and we've got an awful lot of construction that was done 80s and 90s that have these great rooms or these cathedral ceiling areas trying to get this large open feeling, it actually can be advantageous to run that fan in the wintertime. Again, you don't want it blowing on you. The air that stratifies up high, if you've got a 12-foot ceiling or a higher, you can have the air at the top of it be 5 or 6 degrees warmer than the air at the bottom of the room. And so you turn this fan on the slowest, I mean the lowest setting that you can get, just to where it's barely moving around. And what it does is helps reduce this stratification, or the separation of the heat from the rest of the house, and keeps things moving. Since most of the time your heat is either going towards the ceiling, but your cold is coming in from the walls, or hopefully you've got enough insulation it's not from the ceiling. Cold walls, if you are near a cold wall, your body will act as a radiant heater, and you will radiate heat towards that cool wall, so you will feel cool in the room even if the temperature is relatively warm. So by turning this ceiling fan to a low speed, drawing up, it takes the warm air at the top and pushes it on around the outsides of the room or down the outside walls, and puts that warm air barrier between your body and that cooler wall or cooler window. And again, a high ceiling, particularly in the case we were just talking about, the church areas, that can actually make the building or room feel much more comfortable, because you're no longer radiating your body heat towards the cool wall, because there's a warmer air barrier between you and that wall. So a ceiling fan can work well in the wintertime. You just don't turn it up on high and expect it to do something, because the air at the top is not warm enough to feel comfortable if it's a draft or a breeze.
Okay, very good. Let's talk with some other callers here. Line three, Champagne. Hello. Third caller there in Champagne on line number three.
Oh, must have lost one.
Maybe not. In any case, other callers are certainly welcome to call 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. And I think, yes, in fact, we do have a call on line three in Champaign. Go ahead.
Hi.
Yes, hi.
I'm calling in reference to the previous caller. There is the Building Research Council, which is affiliated with the U of I, and there's an operation there called CDAG, which does energy audits for commercial and some public buildings.
And you're actually the second person who have called in and said and mentioned that. So
and if they can't help him, they might.
And that's
know
the
somebody who can.
That's the Smart Energy Design Assistance Center.
Correct.
That's what it stands for, and it's a .org. So, and I just found it by putting it into my computer, CEDAC. So that's SEDAC .org. People should try that. Well, I appreciate the tip.
Okay, thanks.
All right, thank you.
It's going to make me look bad, since my father did work for the University of Illinois Small Homes Council, Building Research Council, for 35 some odd years, but he's been retired for enough years now. I don't keep track of what they're up and doing. So that's a very good service if it's available over there.
And it's apparently this is something that the School of Architecture is involved in. And again, I just say, for people who are interested, go to their website. That's CEDAC, so SEDAC.org, and you can find out what they have available.
Because it's mostly for commercial type.
I don't know, but apparently a couple people thought at least that this would be something that would be helpful for the kind of information the caller was looking for. Okay, let us go then next to somebody else here, and that would be line number two, and that's Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just wanted to chime in and say I've used ceiling fans for years, exactly the way you described them, especially in the winter, and they do make a noticeable difference, not only in the comfort, but also I have a hard time substantiating this, but I think it does, in fact, help reduce one's heating costs because it keeps the room temperature a little more even and so forth. The only problem I've ever had with them is members of the opposite sex, whenever they come into a room in the winter and they see a ceiling fan on, they instantly become cold. And there's no cure for that I've been able to find yet. There's some sort of psychosomatic reaction there that is beyond all understanding, and that's the only caveat I would have to that, is that a lot of people will look at these things spinning away overhead and say, oh, my, what have you got the fan on for, even though it's going up instead of down. So That's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
All right. Well, people can conduct their own study at home.
I was
going to
say, that one may be a little bit out of the scope of my my expertise for sure on the program here. But, yes, a ceiling fan, as long as it's not moving fast, will give you a better – and I'll emphasize perceived comfort level. You will feel warmer, so therefore you are more comfortable in the room at a lower setting. So instead of the room needing to be 78 degrees to be comfortable, it may be able to be 76 or 66 and 68, however you like your home. And when you do drop it a couple degrees, that it does translate into energy savings.
Yeah, okay. One more quick word here. We were talking a bit earlier about CDAC. Let me just read to you what it says off their webpage where it says who they are. The Smart Energy Design Assistance Center provides advice and analysis enabling private and public facilities in the state of Illinois to increase their economic viability through the efficient use of energy resources. It's sponsored by the Illinois Department of Community and Economic Opportunity in partnership with ComEd and Ameren Illinois Utilities, provides services at no cost to for-profit businesses and public facilities, and it's managed by the School of Architecture here at U of I Urbana-Champaign and also the 360 Energy Group. So again, if that sounds like that would be the kind of help that you would need, you get on to their website, cdac.org, and or give them a call, and I'm sure that they would try to help you out. At least they'd tell you right off, can they help you or can they not?
That's,
and you go from there.
That's a good place to start.
All right. Let's go next to somebody who is traveling through our area, I understand, on our line number four. Hello.
Hello. I'm calling on the road. I live in Cincinnati, Ohio, and I'm listening to your station, and I've got a mold problem in my basement. I have a new furnace, and they installed another cold air return to try to move the air in the basement, but it has not changed the situation down there. There is no visible water in the basement, but there is mold in the basement. And I'm wondering who I should go to next to try to resolve the problem.
Well, basically, in order for mold to grow, it's got to have two things. It's got to have moisture, and it's got to have some food. So a little bit of dirt it can grow on, and it's got to have humidity. Without the humidity, the mold will go dormant. So apparently, we do have a high moisture level in the house. Hopefully, when you put the new furnace in, they did not install in a power humidifier. If there is, then there's a good chance the power humidifier is partially responsible for the problem. You'd want to turn it down or off, particularly until you figure out how to get take care of the mold issue. Somewhere there's got to be a water source, because without the humidity, without the moisture, you're not going to get the mold. By putting in a cold air return, yes, you're moving a little bit more air through the basement, but unless the system is taking humidity out, it's still going to be a mold issue.
Well, I put a dehumidifier down there, which is draining directly into a floor drain, and so it's working, but maybe I just need to put more than one. It is a finished basement, so the rooms, you know, there is more than one room. There's an unfinished area where I have the dehumidifier, but it doesn't seem to be, and that's where the most of the smell is coming from.
The dehumidifier will do its job from any room in the house because it does create a low vapor pressure, and all the moisture in the house will tend to want to move that direction. So you shouldn't need to run more than one, and it doesn't need to be in each individual room. So that should work. You're going to need to find your mold areas and probably spray them down with a little bit of Clorox or bleach of some type that will help kill off the mold spores. Is this mold that you're actually seeing, or is this just kind of an odor issue that you're finding in the basement?
It's an odor issue, but then I have seen mold actually on a leather sofa down there. And I used SporaClean, which has worked really, really well for a short period of time in terms of, you know, making the smell go away. And I've wiped every surface there is down there with the SporaClean, but it comes back.
Well, if it's coming back, then you've got a humidity or higher humidity level than what I think that should have in the house. You might try getting a hygrometer. Usually one of the local electronic stores, hate to throw brand names out there, but I drop by Radio Shack and they've got these little hygrometer units for about $15 or so that'll tell you what the humidity level is in the particular room that you've got it set there, and give you an idea of what moisture levels are there, and what, then we need to figure out, okay, if they're indeed high, why, and where's that water level moisture coming from? And a home inspector is a good place to start for something like that, because most of them are capable of looking for the moisture sources.
Okay, great. I will. your help.
Okay, well, thanks very much. We'll try to get one more caller real quick here. Champaign, line 3. Hello. Well, okay, maybe not. if somebody wants to call real quick, I'm sure that we could get him in. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Okay, let's see. We're going to go to line number 1. Very good. Right here, the caller on line 1. Hello.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Hi, I have a question about a smoke detector, carbon monoxide detector in my home.
Mm-hmm.
It keeps burning out the batteries in it, and I'm just trying to figure out. It's the one that's in the laundry room right where the water heater is and the washer and dryer. I'm trying to figure out if maybe carbon monoxide is getting into that particular carbon monoxide detector because it keeps going off.
Well, what I would probably do is I'd trade it out for another one in the house and see if it moves. Yes, if the dryer is a gas dryer and not vented outside, it could be creating a carbon monoxide problem. But
okay.
These things are relatively inexpensive, and when they retail for anywhere from $12 to $25, the quality control is not particularly high. So it is possible to get a defective unit or one with a sensor that is overly sensitive or even will sense falsely.
Okay.
So what I would do is if you've got one in one place that seems to want to trip, move it to someplace else and bring another one into that room. Now, if it still goes off in that room, then obviously there is a problem in that room. But if it then starts going off in the hallway, spring for a new detector.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. And if you had a gas dryer, that the reason it might be setting it off is that it's not venting and you are actually getting – and I suppose it could be just a very small amount. It could be just right there. But if your detector is also right there, well, it's going to go off.
In order to get carbon monoxide, we've got to have some type of flame. And anytime we burn flame, we do produce carbon oxide, monoxide, some sulfur oxides, a little bit of anything, that moisture vapor, stuff like that. Yes, it should be vented to the outside. It could be that we've got a hose that's come off. Now, most of the time, if the flame is actually burning correctly, a nice blue flame, it is not producing enough carbon monoxide to actually be setting off a detector or be what I consider a high level. I've put very sensitive testers directly into a flue pipe for a water heater or directly into a furnace, and when burning properly, they're producing anywhere from 12 to 20 parts per million, and most of the alarms that you put in the wall sound off at about 35 parts per million. So until the flame starts burning poorly, it's really not what I call lethal levels, although a long-term exposure to low levels of carbon monoxide can be as dangerous as a high-level short-term.
Yeah.
So it is something you want to check. But when I get one that goes off intermittently and can't find a source for it, the first thing I do is switch it out with another one. And if the noise moves, then you throw the detector away and pick up a new one.
Okay. And you do want to make sure you have some kind of a gas appliance, whether you're talking about a dryer, you're talking about a water heater, you're talking about a furnace. You do need to make sure that they are venting to the outside properly in whatever mechanism, whether it goes up a chimney, whether it goes – it's direct vented out the side, whatever it is, you have to make sure that that is venting the way that it should, that there's nothing blocking that.
Yeah. So basically cleaning of the appliances once in a while to make sure they're burning properly and making sure that the vent systems are functional. It's not uncommon this time of year to find a squirrel making a nest in a chimney that kind of blocks things up. So if you start getting an alarm going off, it is cause for concern, and you want to track down where the source is.
All right. There we got to leave it this time around. Our guest, Scott Spies, is a home inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's here once a month, always on a Monday. We talk about home maintenance. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, David.